thanks very much. There is no training scheme for handling our cutting. Always great to discuss with him, though. So thanks to the coordinators for the...
This will never fade out.
No. Wouldn't want it to either. thanks to the coordinators for the invitation. It's very nice to be back here again. I'm an outsider. I don't work with Lattice QCD, which could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your mood. Hopefully I can talk a little bit about some motivating aspects in beyond the standard model physics, and talk about some certainly some QCD that will come into some of the physics that I'll discuss. So I know we had a couple of talks on muon anomalous magnetic moment on Friday. So I'm going to be switching to the electric dipole moment as one example of types of precision tests that are, you know, I think of interest in the current situation that we find ourselves in, with lack of any distinct signatures for new physics from various sectors. So I'll use it as one example and mention some areas where lattice QCD is being used to try and increase the precision. So the first part of the talk will be more specific, I guess, on EDMs. The second part of the talk will be more philosophical, which is perhaps back to front. Normally you would do it the other way around, but if you want to fall asleep at later part of the talk, then you won't miss the details. Of course, if you want to fall asleep, you can do that at any part of the talk. But we'll see how that goes. So the first part will focus mainly on EDMs. But let me just say a couple of words as part of motivation. So I'm going to be focusing on precision observables, which, you know, the language is a little vague, but often it means, you know, measuring something with, you know, as much precision as you can experimentally, as distinct, say, from what's usually called the intensity frontier these days, where there you're getting high precision through having a lot of a large sample size. So EDMs are an example of the former rather than the latter, although in practice you still need good statistics to get the precision that's of interest these days. But what I'll be focusing on is a kind of a broader landscape, I guess. So this is a very simple schematic picture to introduce tests for new physics. Direct searches, if you put them on a two-dimensional plot here, an energy scale versus coupling, or what I call visibility here. You know, normally we think of having everything kind of clear up to some short distance scale or some ultraviolet energy scale. But in practice, we also have limited sensitivity and coupling as well. So there could be new physics which is not heavy, in quotes, I guess, in the sense that it's above the electroweak scale. It could actually be relatively light. And I'll mention a little bit more later in the talk why that might be of interest. And, you know, in practice, we don't see either this or this at the moment, although we have good motivations for thinking something should be there. And so it's useful to look at observables that are sensitive to both. And of course, there really is a continuum, but it's useful sometimes to separate it out like this. And so I'll say a little bit more in the second part of the talk about ways to think about how precision observables test new physics that might be like this versus new physics, which is purely at short distances. And of course, you know, for the context of this workshop, as soon as you go to low energies, then generically low energy QCD becomes an issue, and so there's direct relevance for lattice QCD. Okay, so two parts to the talk. The first one is more technical. They're kind of the same, but I'll mainly talk about EDM specifically in the first part of the talk, and then I'll say some more generic things about precision tests and what they say about new physics. Okay, so this is probably unnecessary, certainly in this audience, just a general slide about CP violation. Obviously, you would have, I think you've had talks about CP violation in you know, the meson sector, KMB mesons. I'm going to be talking about different kind of CP violation in the sense that it doesn't require violation of flavor. And this is already kind of, there's a very neat dichotomy within the standard model as to what's going on, because, you know, CP violation, at least up to choice of basis, is determined by the Yukawa couplings, one basis invariant that you can write down is order one, as you might expect it to be, basis invariant phase. And to first approximation, of course, this explains, or is a good explanation of CP violation in meson mixing and decays. The other one, which is, again, basis dependent, but in this form is just kind of an overall phase of the eukaryote, which is equivalent to the strong CP phase, is highly constrained. And we don't know why, right? This is, of course, the strong CP problem. So it makes this an interesting subject. This one, as I said, it accesses the flavor structure of the eukaryote. This one doesn't. So it's flavor diagonal CP violation. And EDMs are just excellent probes of the latter type of CP violation. That's where that remarkable constraint on theta comes from. So just in terms of motivation, again, CP violation is interesting because we apparently need it for baryogenesis. And it tends to be generic. There may well be CP violating phases in the lepton sector as well, given that we see massive neutrinos. And you know, this suppression of theta is again another motivation for looking for new sources. So EDMs are just, well, simple definition in terms of particles with spin interacting with the external electric field. And the best limits are, in roughly speaking, in these three categories of either paramagnetic or diamagnetic atoms and molecules. Currently in the paramagnetic case, the best limit comes from a group, the experiment based at Harvard on thorium oxide. This is primarily sensitive to CP violation of the electron, the unpaired electron in a paramagnetic atom. Diamagnetic systems don't have such sensitivity to the electron, but sensitivity to the CP violating moments of the nucleus.
Is that argon experiment that you have listed there, that's going to start with 15?
Oh no, they have a result actually. It's preliminary in the sense that they didn't have high statistics, but they published a paper with a result. It's not competitive with the Washington experiment, but yeah, it came out a few months ago. So it is working. It's the first constraint on an EDM using an atomic trap. So yeah, their real problem is getting, you know, statistics. So they really need another source to be able to try and be competitive with the University of Washington experiment. But they are keeping going, yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's certainly a technological achievement that they managed to make this work.
Are they going to move to F-ray at some stage?
Or? I think that's one of the options. Yeah, as I said, the source is important. They need higher statistics, but they have some other ways of doing that. So I don't know exactly what the plan is, but I know that that's been touted as a possibility. Yeah. Yeah. So I should mention the experiments that I've listed here all have results. There are many others that are in development, but these have actually published results. And the ones that are highlighted here are give the strongest limits. So these are the atomic and molecular systems, and then of course there are strong constraints just on the neutron medium, the neutron itself. Okay, so one of the reasons that these are powerful probes is that the standard model, and when I say standard model here, I mean CKM phase contribution is really small. You can estimate it. It's actually quite hard to calculate it with any precision, but perhaps it's not that well motivated to do it with high precision because it's so small. So the one in which the experimental limit is actually closest is probably the neutron. So I'll say a bit more about these coefficients. These are actually coefficients of four quark operators. But the characteristic scaling here is always second order in G Fermi and proportional to the Yalskog, reduced Yalskog invariant, just the CP invariant phase. Because it's flavor diagonal, it has to be proportional to J directly. So this gives you the characteristic scale in practice, and so it's always relatively small. So here, maybe six orders of magnitude. For mercury, again, a similar contribution, but maybe a couple of orders of magnitude more away from the standard model. And this constraint on the EDM of the electron is actually the one that has the most scope in principle for pushing down even further. I should say these two limits probably will be improved. This experiment, the University of Washington experiment, has been taking data for the last couple of years, and they should be putting out a new result fairly soon. I mean, either they'll see something or they'll push this limit down by probably close to another order of magnitude. And similarly, this collaboration is continuing. They have a number of developments they can work on, and I think they have room in principle to go down a couple of orders of magnitude there as well. But anyway, in terms of standard model background, it's small, and maybe that's important in relation to the muon anomalous magnetic moment, where of course the standard model contribution is large, or large in terms of the anomaly or the discrepancy. And so you need high precision to do anything. For EDMs, you don't need high precision to see new physics, right? You need good control of the experiment. You need to be able to say that the systematics are under control, which is the crucial thing, of course, the most difficult thing. But you don't necessarily need high precision of calculation to make that statement, because you know, these are just estimates, but you can pretty easily convince yourself that they're not off by six orders of magnitude.
There is really two orders of magnitude, the uncertainty in the hadronic matrix element.
I mean, this is not terribly precise, but it's not good. And that's actually true for all of these. These are all actually dominated by hadronic matrix elements, even though this is nominally an electron. As I'll mention, this interaction is actually semi-leptonic, so it's the electron with the nucleus, so they're all dominated by hadronic uncertainties. So I was saying that, you know, it's not crucial for sort of perhaps proving that you're seeing something new, but if you want to interpret it, then you do need to calculate it, and of course that's why it's interesting. You know, seeing something without being able to interpret it is not as valuable, clearly. So there is motivation in trying to increase the precision in all of these calculations. Okay, so just general overview of this picture, I guess, of how some fundamental source of CP violation would feed into the observable measurement, and one could make a similar plot for pretty much any precision observable. It's always a little bit messy. The scales here are a sort of arbitrary choice of basis, right, where you want to start. So I'll make this precise in a second, but you know, one can write down a set of operators involving, say, leptons, quarks, electrons, muons, and so on, at around the QCD scale. It's a convenient basis in practice. Then those things will feed into nuclear scale quantities, and eventually, in this case, down to atomic scale observables. And the ones in red, again, are the ones that have been, measured is probably not the right term to use, since the measurement is always zero, but there are limits available for all of those. And then the fundamental source of CP violation, I've written it, I've drawn it here up the top, sort of traditional picture of it being a short distance source of new physics, but as I emphasized right at the beginning, this could in principle feed in anywhere here, right? We could have new physics, which is CP violating with a different scale, and I'll come back to that at the end. But for the moment, I'll just stick with this sort of picture. So just to set the notation, write down a basis of CP violating operators normalized at around the QCD scale, just as a convenient choice. It's probably the simplest basis to use. One could write it at the electroweak scale, but it's slightly more complicated there. And the structure looks like this. So the first one you can write down is the theta term, GG dual, dimension 4. Nominally dimension 5, but if you think about the Higgs insertion required to flip the chirality, these are dimension 6. So the EDM of the quark, this F sigma gamma 5 structure, is what you need to get E dot S, dotted into the electric field and the non-relativistic limit. There, we're in QCD, right? So there's a gluonic version of that chromo EDM. These are all summed over the light quarks, since we're assuming this is around a GeV, so everything else is integrated out, and then the leptons. And you can keep going. Three gluon CP violating operator, Weinberg operator. There's a special class of four fermion operators that are not chirally suppressed, so they really are dimension 6, but they do require some left-right mixing, which is not present in the standard model, and so for many years they were sort of left off the list, primarily because they're always small in supersymmetric models like the MSSM. And then more generic for fermion operators, for quark operators, semi-leptonic operators. And these are, again, they have two chirality flipping insertions, so they're nominally dimension 8, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily irrelevant. And in fact, those standard model contributions, CKM contributions that I showed you before, are of this type. They come from these types of operators, just because of QCD, essentially. You can make them large. They're also interesting in certain supersymmetric models because they can be enhanced through tan beta. So again, this is just to emphasize the chirality structure. One Higgs insertion here, two Higgs insertions here. And as I said, this looks like it's more important, but it relies on some new source of left-right mixing, and so it's model-dependent. Now, for the purpose of this talk, I'm mainly going to focus just on these operators here, which are nominally the leading ones and the ones that are relevant for questions around QCD calculation. Okay, so once you've set a basis like that, the problem is to calculate, and you want to be able to calculate quantities that are getting closer to the things you'd actually measure. So you want to take all of those operators and look at their contributions to, say, nuclear or nucleon scale quantities, so write down some effective Lagrangian in terms of nucleons, pions and nucleons, or including electrons as well. And this is an area where there's been a lot of nice work actually recently systematizing the chiral counting to work out, you know, at least with normal chiral scaling, how these different pionucleon couplings and the EDMs depend on the different coefficients that appear here. This is just symmetry based, right? It's just assuming normal chiral scaling, which may or may not apply, but up to enhancements, that's what you'd expect. Now, of course, that's part of the story, but in the end of the day, you want to calculate it. You need the numbers. But what it did show was that the coefficients here that people have traditionally used as the dominant ones actually, you know, usually are the dominant ones. So the EDMs of the neutron and the proton, the isoscalar and isovector pionucleon couplings, and this electron EDM and the semileptonic scalar or pseudoscalar operator. There are also others. There are four nucleon interactions, pion interactions, and so on. And they're not always negligible either. Like, at least in chiral counting, these are not suppressed relative to the others. So those were the new ones.
The systematic work you mentioned sort of develops a chart relating the short distance coefficients and the pop plots to the...
Yeah, yeah. You have to, I mean, you're basically saying, you know, what's the... If I look at full chiral symmetry and I look at the way these coefficients act as spurions for breaking of that chiral symmetry, how many powers do I need? And so it tells you what the scaling should be. It doesn't tell you any coefficients, but it says this one should be much larger than this one. And so you can at least argue that certain quantities will be suppressed, unless there are enhancements, which of course sometimes there are, right? Chiral counting doesn't always work, but it's a pretty good guide. So yeah, that's... I've just written it very schematically here, but if you look in these papers, it's worked out in lots of detail. And then, of course, the last step is to go from that nucleon scale or nuclear scale down to the observable measurements. And I won't say much about this. I've got some more material that I'll put in backup slides if you want to have a look later. But this is a quick summary of what happens. When you go to the atomic scale, interesting things occur because you're usually looking at either neutral atoms or neutral molecules. And so when you apply the external electric field, it gets screened. And so what you see is a more complicated effect which violates that screening. So in the case of the paramagnetic systems, there's a relativistic violation of screening, and there's a huge enhancement factor, particularly for these polarizable molecules. So basically the electric field that the unpaired electron sees is enhanced by many orders of magnitude due to that polarization. So it's actually a really good way of looking for CP violation in the electron, to not look at the electron directly, but to put it inside one of these polarizable molecules and then look for the effect on the molecule. So in practice, you can look for shifts in the, so the measurement is a shift in the precession frequency, right? You turn on a small magnetic field, look at the Larmor precession frequency, and then look for shifts as you switch the orientation of the electric field. Now, it's a vast simplification of what the experiment is, but that's basically the idea. And the shift that you need to measure in this system is actually, not that small. It's millihertz scale, which is not, in principle, that difficult. And that's because of the huge enhancement. So these effects are given the name of Schiff because he worked out some of the dominant moments that occur in these atomic systems. And there's a sort of standard theorem now that goes under the name of Schiff screening for the effects that occur when you put these CP-violating sources in atomic or molecular systems. So that's, in principle, a big advantage. The disadvantage is you have to work with complicated molecules, and in fact, excited states of those molecules. So you have to be able to produce this source, which is really hard. And that was the great breakthrough that they managed to take advantage of with John Doyle's lab in Harvard. So he's very good at producing these polarizable, or the exciting the states in these particular molecules. Yes, so this is actually what gives us the dominant constraint of the EDM, the electron. So this is this number here.
I know it's got more than also.
Yes, there are many others. So I when I put the list up before, it's here actually. Yeah, so they've been playing around with another. It's actually, in their case, it's an iron as well. But yes, there are a number of other groups that are playing with similar kinds of molecules. But for the moment, this is the one that dominates in terms of measurement.
How do you think the contribution of the electron from other?
Right. So I'm not going to say a lot about the electron case, but in that system, generally you can't. So the problem is that you've got multiple contributions. And all you can say is, well, let me assume that one of them dominates, and then that's where you get the limit. But it's an important point because, in fact, let me come back here. So for any of those systems that are nominally stated as measuring or constraining the EDM, the electron, they're actually sensitive to both these contributions because it's always it's in an atomic or a molecular system. So the electron interacts with the nucleus, and so both of these are present. And in fact, when you account for this screening effect, they're not that different. If you look at them at sort of nuclear level, they kind of come together. And in fact, the relative coefficients are very similar for different atomic species or even molecular species. So even measuring two of them, it makes it quite hard to disentangle the two. So it is a tricky point. Yes, that's right. Yeah. But a very similar band, unfortunately. Yeah, they're almost parallel, in fact.
They're different base spin structure, right? Because the second one, I mean, the first one involves spin away from the second one.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they're not the same. But it just so happens that when you look at the relative coefficients of those contributions in the types of molecules that people have been working with, they end up being almost the same. So yeah, you get a constraint in some two-dimensional plane. It's a first approximation. I mean, there are also dots here, but these are usually the dominant ones. So you get a band in two-dimensional plane. And unfortunately, that band, you know, you'd like to measure two systems and have two bands like this, but in practice, they're like this. So if you really want to get a constraint, it's quite hard. In practice, the constraint is on a linear combination of these two coefficients. So it's a good point. I'll mention it briefly. This is not a big problem. They're known at the moment to around 30%, but well, that's the estimate. Most people seem to think you could increase that a lot if you wanted to. Yeah. That's an atomic calculation. So that's not as concerning as other cases that I'll mention. It's probably again a case where one could improve it.
QED in atomic systems versus QCD in nuclear
systems. Yeah. Yes. So not a surprise, right? Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of a nice case, you could say, because you get more than you perhaps thought you were going to get from this enhancement. When you look at things like the neutron, well, there's no real enhancement, so the constraint that you get on a neutron EDM, roughly speaking, translates directly to constraints on these quark-level operators or coefficients. And for nuclear systems, this screening effect that I talked about really does apply, and you're totally insensitive to the EDM of the nucleus itself, despite you might think that's the thing you'd be measuring. In fact, you don't see it at all. What you see are sub-leading higher-order moments, which are CP-violating, so-called shift moment is usually the dominant one, although it could be the magnetic quadrupole moment as well. But that does suppress the actual sensitivity. So you go from, in this case, of the Mercury EDM experiment at the University of Washington, they're able to measure shifts in the precession frequency which are below a nanohertz, which is a remarkable thing to do. But the actual sensitivity ends up being similar to the others because of this suppression factor. And in fact, this is probably the system that's most difficult in terms of calculation. I'll mention that later on. So that factor is quite uncertain, probably by an order of magnitude. But such an impressive experiment that that's really unfortunate in many ways, that that precision seems to be hard to improve. But that's one area where QCT does come in. Okay, so that's all I'll say about the sort of general picture, particularly for these quantities that are sensitive to nuclear CP violation. There are two important sort of calculational problems here. One is QCD scale, so going from gluon operators to nuclear matrix elements. And then there's a second nuclear scale, so from nucleons to the nucleus itself, which is also quite problematic in the case of mercury, where you want to calculate these higher order nuclear moments as a function of, say, pi-nucleon couplings or four-nucleon couplings and so on. This is not a huge problem for some systems. It just happens to be a very big problem for mercury. I should mention, going back here, you know, the reason, of course, that it's possible to have this huge differential in experimental sensitivity is, you know, mercury is relatively well behaved. You put it in a cell, you can study it, probe it with lasers and so on. Whereas here, you have to work with these highly unstable radioactive molecules. So you're taking advantage here of working with a system that's relatively benign.
So in models where you have large EDM, typically the electron and the neutron are about the same place, or there's a large difference?
It's a model dependent question, because in principle, let me go back here. Oops. Oh yeah. So, you know, there's not necessarily a connection between the CP violation that you would see from here and the CP violation you would see here. You know, if I write down a model that only has one CP violating source, then of course they're all correlated. But this is in the lepton sector, this is in the quark sector. You know, in supersymmetric models, for example, they're usually they're independent phases unless you make some extra assumptions that correlate them. So, difficult question to answer. It's model dependent. So, you know, to first approximation, take a step back and just say, well, I'd like to understand the dependence on all of those coefficients, and then you can plug in a model and see what you get. Yeah, it's a hard one to kind of put a number on it. I think there were some benchmark numbers that have been used, because it's a question of what you think is a natural phase to write down. So in certain classes of supersymmetric models, you might say that the natural phase is, in general, you'd say the natural phase is order one. And then you say, well, what EDM does that order one phase produce? And if you take a characteristic model and you work it out, you'll probably get something like 10 to the minus 25 for the electron EDM.
That is and bias, right? If your model gives an EDM that is above one, you can write the paper.
Yeah.
If you give it, if you
get an estimate that is way below the limit, you don't mention it in the paper, but if it's just under the current limits, then it's, you know, got gold.
That's perfect, yeah. But just to answer the... Absolutely true. Just to answer the question, though, so if you do that calculation, you'll get maybe 10 to the minus 24 or 10 to the minus 25, which is already excluded. And so this was what was called the SUSY CP problem, that order one phases didn't work there either. Unless you made the mass spectrum, tuned the mass spectrum, made it quite heavy, which now you have to do anyway, because the LHC has kind of ruled it out. The numbers like 10 to the minus 29 tended to come from the statement that if you stick in CP violation in a more generic way and you don't try to tune it particularly, most of the contributions to EDMs occur at two loops. So there's an extra loop factor suppression. So that takes you down more to the 10 to the minus 28, 10 to the minus 29. So if you assume it's a two-loop diagram, perturbative two-loop diagram that generates it, then that gives you a number like that. But it's hard to... you know, say any more about, you know, what's natural, what's unnatural. But it's at least that gives you some kind of a benchmark. Okay, so I'll focus on this corner of the diagram for the rest of this first part of the talk anyway, and just say a little bit more about calculation. So again, as I said, the first part of the problem, the QCD part of the problem, is to calculate these coefficients, as many as you can in principle, as a function of all of those underlying quark-gluon sources. Now, the first question, of course, you should ask is why? Why do I need to calculate these things? Can't I just do simple estimates? And you can. So people have used NDA. To do this, and it's just chiral counting, it really is the same thing. So you can work out what the rough dependence should be. These are just a few examples, theta, quark EDM, quark chromo EDM, and then the neutron EDM, and one of the CP violating pion nucleon couplings. And so you can get an order of magnitude estimate fairly easily that way. And, you know, this is perhaps good enough, right? Remember, I mentioned right at the beginning that if you can measure or you measure something which is non-zero at the current level, you know that it's not the standard model contribution. What's the motivation, perhaps, for going any further? Well, as you know, again, it's interpretation. So if you have multiple sources, you'd like to be able to separate them out in one way or another. Maybe with one measurement you can't do much, but if you had two measurements, and there are lots of experiments in principle that could detect something, you need ways to be able to disentangle them. Now, the original motivation, probably 15 years ago, certainly when I started working on this subject, was a little different. It was more to constrain particular types of models. Back in the 1990s, everyone expected SUSY to be discovered tomorrow or yesterday. Not quite like that now, I think. But anyway, at the time, there was a lot of emphasis on looking at the different constraints you could impose on the parameter space from EDM measurements. And so again, you needed a tool to be able to calculate these things. And the other thing, of course, is that NDA gives you characteristic scaling, same way as chiral counting, but there are possibilities for significant enhancements or suppression factors. Think of epsilon prime over epsilon as an example. So again, there are motivations for doing that. But you need, if you want to do it, then you need a way of being able to calculate all of these things in the same, using the same technique to be systematic. So I'll just mention briefly the QCD sum rules calculation. I think it's, well, hopefully it's relevant here because the technique is the same as the one you'd use in lattice QCD. It's really the same, the first approximation anyway, the same quantity that you're calculating. Look at a two-point function of nucleon correlators or currents that have the quantum numbers of the neutron in this case, and we'll put it in the background with CP violation and also an external electric field, and so you're looking really at this term in an expansion in powers of the external field. Now the difference, of course, is that you can't do the usual separation in Euclidean space of trying to isolate the ground state directly. Here it's just a parameterization of that nucleon propagator. So here's the leading term would be a double pole term. There are single pole terms as well. And then various contributions from excited states that you can try to suppress in various ways. In this case, it turns out that it's useful to isolate a particular tensor structure in that propagator because it's invariant under chiral rotations that mix the EDM and the magnetic dipole moment structure. So one of the issues here is that once you turn on CP violation, these nucleon interpolating currents are not chirally invariant anymore. They pick up a phase proportional to the CP violation, which is unphysical. And so that, if you didn't worry about it, you would end up mixing what you think of as the EDM and the magnetic dipole moment. So one way is to measure it. One way out of this is to measure that phase. But what we did instead was to isolate this particular tensor structure, which turns out to be independent of it. So you can do that. And then you're trying to read off EDM here, which is this coefficient. So you want to get rid of this one and suppress the higher order terms. And then you calculate the left-hand side using the operator product expansion. Or generalized to include vacuum condensates. So this is just sort of a schematic picture of that diagrammatic expansion. The nucleon interpolator here is up to you, but the simplest ones just have the valence quark contributions with the appropriate matrix structure to get the quantum numbers right. The other slight subtlety is that these currents mix with CP conjugate currents, which is an effect that you do have to account for to get the right physical dependence on the CP violating sources, but that you can do just rediagonalization. And the QCD sum rules approach is essentially a self-consistent fit for all of these parameters. So you've got a fit for the nucleon mass, the EDM. This is the coupling to the interpolating current. So lambda here is this combination. This beta parameter is an annoying thing. It comes in because there are two currents of the same dimension, lowest dimension nucleon currents. And so in general, you have a linear combination like this. But at the end of the day, you want to fit for all of these parameters and see if you get a consistent stability region for the sum rule. That's a good question. In this case, it'll be CP odd. It's the same structure. So it is, yeah, so this is one of these annoying parameters. And maybe it could be interesting. One could try to measure it. But what it corresponds to, I haven't got a diagram here, but it corresponds to mixing between the ground state nucleon and excited state through the photon. So a three-point vertex with one of the states being excited. So it would be a CP violating coupling, but it's not a CP violating parameter for the neutron itself. But it is problematic. I mean, as I said, in principle, you need enough sum rules to try and fit for it. In the end, we sort of convinced ourselves that it was small, but it would be nice to actually measure it to see. But yeah, it would be another CP violating mixing between, say, the neutron first excited state with the same quantum numbers. So there are a number of parameters there, but this is true in general for QCD sum rules. Now, Arkady, of course, is the expert here, but he was smart enough not to try and do QCD sum rules for baryons. It works a lot more nicely. It's a much neater problem for mesons. As soon as you start looking at baryons, and particularly when you start looking at baryons in external fields, it's tricky. There are these single pole terms which don't exist for the mesons. Don't exist in the absence of external fields. And then one still has to try and suppress the excited states. That's usually easier. You can use a Borel transform or something. But these terms are not really suppressed, and you have to fit for them. So what we do is try to use different sum rules that are not just calculating the EDM, but calculating things like the mass, pioneer nucleon sigma term, because they're all sensitive to things like this, the mass or the nucleon coupling. Those are all CPU even quantities, and so you can try to get a self-consistent fit. So this is what we ended up with many years ago. Not great precision, 50% or something like that, which comes from trying to estimate the effect of these higher order terms and things like this ambiguity in the choice of the interpolating current. But it's it's an estimate of the precision. And then these are the different parameters that enter. So there are certain vacuum condensates. You have the possibility of tensor condensates here because you've got the external electric field, so you can violate Lorentz invariance. So chi here turns out to be an important one. It's this tensor condensate in the electric field background, or in principle, any electromagnetic background. This magnetic dipole, or chromomagnetic dipole condensate, denoted N naught squared. And then another combination of mixed condensates that are called alpha. So these terms all enter roughly at the same order. This is the quark EDM, this is theta. These are some of the chromo EDMs. These are actually the dominant contribution to the chromo EDMs. And there's also a strange quark contribution that comes in. So this is a C contribution that comes in from looking at the rediagonalization of the condensate. It's not in the nucleon interpolator. And so you're clearly not seeing everything in the strange sector here. It's one piece. It's very hard to get strange quark contributions in this sort of perturbative expansion where you're only working with valence quarks in the nucleon. You'd have to go to high order to see it. And in practice, the expansion gets intractable in that limit because you end up with condensates that are non-local and you don't know how to numerically estimate them. But I wrote down the whole thing here just to show you the structure, quark mass dependence, the charges, and so on. You can get the same result for the proton just by flipping U and D. It's the same, just because of the structure of the currents.
So the E sub D and E sub U are the electron charges.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So the first term is the one from the beta parameter, obviously, and the others are all beyond the standard model.
Yeah, I mean, depending on whether you call this beyond standard model or not, yes. Yeah. Yeah, this doesn't include CKM, for example. This is just the terms we wrote down before. One thing to emphasize, and I'll come back to this in a second, the coefficient here is proportional to the normal chiral condensate. And we normalized it based on sort of traditional sum rules fit at around 225 MeV, which is somewhat lower than the number that would be used now. And there's also an estimate for this coupling, which again comes from looking at fitting different sum rules. But I'll come back to that again, because it's a question, again, perhaps one of the most interesting questions is the size of this number.
So everything is proportional to the condensate?
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically from things like this. Here it doesn't look like it, but the way it comes out, you can see you get combinations like this. So in practice, this always appears as an overall factor. There's no gluon condensate term in here, basically because you have so many quark lines in the nucleon correlator that you always have to send quarks to the vacuum somewhere. M star is just the reduced light quark mass. So. Oh, so these are the electric dipole moments of the quarks. The ones with the tilde have the electric field replaced by the chromo electric field. So the chromo EDMs just replace the photon with the gluon. So they in principle they could be quite different for various reasons. They come in a similar way, basically through this vacuum realignment that you get. Although this term is independent of that. And I should mention, so we did this calculation many, many years ago. It was repeated by Junji Hasano and collaborators a few years ago, just direct repeat, same calculation, which was nice because they checked it. And in the end, they got the same result for the structures anyway, apart from this term, where they have slightly different coefficients here. And in the end, it doesn't have a huge numerical effect, but we weren't able to kind of cross-check very easily because, well, my excuse is that when I left Minnesota, back in the old days, there was no Dropbox, so I had to ship papers. This calculation was done while I was at the University of Minnesota. I had to ship papers, and you go to the post office and get one of these bags, post bag, to send overseas. And you put all your papers in it, and you kind of seal it, and cross your fingers and hope that it arrives at the other end. And I moved to my next job, waited for 3 months because it was sent by sea. This bag arrived with lots of gaffer tape over it and some note saying at some point it got damaged and they'd reattached it. But some of the notes were missing. And unfortunately, the notes calculating that one were missing. Now, I didn't worry about it at the time because this was like a 5% correction, really, compared to this one. So I wasn't worried about it. That's my excuse anyway. But actually, with these changes, this becomes somewhat larger. But it's still maybe 30%, something like that. So it'd be nice to check it. That was my excuse. Maxime will have a different excuse, but we have yet to completely verify whether we had a typo or a mistake in the calculation. It wouldn't be a typo, a mistake, and whether they got it right. But since they were checking it, most likely they are right, since they could compare. But this doesn't have a huge numerical effect. It's just I just wanted to mention it. And so when we quoted the numerical results, usually actually this term was dropped previously because it was subleading numerically. Now it may be slightly larger, so it probably should be included. So this is what you get, just sort of isolating different coefficients and plugging in the numbers. This is the theta contribution. Scale is 10 to the minus 16 e centimeters, and so if you remember the limit on the neutron EDM, which is 10 to the minus 26, this is where you get a limit of something like 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11. But again, normalization with this quark condensate. Now, if you have theta at order, say 10 to the minus 10, it dominates everything, and so in practice, you don't really need to worry about any other sources. What's usually done is you have to assume something relaxes theta to zero, say the axion, but if you do that and you have these chromo EDM sources, the axion potential has a linear term, and so it doesn't actually relax to zero. It relaxes to something which is proportional to these chromo EDM sources. So you get an induced value of theta. So theta bar disappears, but it shifts the coefficients of these other terms. And in particular, in this case, it actually exactly cancels the strange quark contribution. As I said, I don't think there's anything special about that. This is just one piece of the strange quark contribution, and there should be others, but they're not calculable using this approach. So then you just end up with this simple expression. It only depends on the quark EDMs and the U and D chromo EDMs, again, with similar coefficient. Right, so I just mentioned this cancellation of the strange quark, but I don't think there's anything too special about it. Now, one of the interesting questions is to ask, you know, one can ask about the structures here, and interestingly, they have the same relative coefficients as you would get from the naive quark model. So you might say, well, why did you do some long calculation and you end up with the same result as the naive quark model? And the answer is, I don't know. There's nothing apparently special about it, and an easy way to see it is that we had to fix the value of this unphysical mixing parameter between the two nucleon currents. And if you choose it differently, then you get a different dependence here. It's not the same. So it seems to be somewhat artificial. It doesn't vary that much, though. I mean, that structure seems to be about right. So maybe it's just saying there's something roughly correct in the naive quark model, and wouldn't be too surprising. And then the other, you know, similar structure here in practice. And then the other question is the overall coefficient. And so I wanted to say a little bit more about that overall coefficient because there have been some lattice calculations recently that kind of bear on that, the question of whether that coefficient is right or not. Now, this is for reference. I've just written it out in slightly more detail here. So dependence on the quark condensate, the nucleon coupling, and then precision of, say, 50%, right, plus or minus. For those coefficients, and here it's just the quark EDM contribution that I'm including. Now, all of these coefficients are consistent with the NDA scaling that I wrote down before. There's no obvious enhancement or suppression factors, but a nice check is you can take the quark EDMs, and of course, just simple algebra, you can show that they're the same, the coefficients are the same as the quark tensor charges, which are calculable. And there have been a sort of series of calculations of these tensor charges over a few years. using various approximations, but recently the Los Alamos group, I guess, has done the most comprehensive calculation, certainly, you know, the most comprehensive one in terms of you know, the physical value of the pion mass, accounting for finite size corrections, and so on. And their numbers are now pretty precise. So here are the coefficients. You know, this is down at the 10% level in terms of precision. So this is roughly 0.7. This is 0.77, 0.23 for the coefficients of the D quark EDM and the U quark EDM normalized at 2 GeV, and the strange quark contribution is consistent with zero.
But the part which was not associated with that moment of quarks, it's also present as the scattering. I mean, even in standard model, right? There is a part which is not. Which is CP violation, but not the Dipole moment, right? It's not included here. Right?
You mean the which the standard model contribution?
You can have CP breaking in, say, inside of nucleon due to some amplitude, right? Which say, I don't know, scattering of some quarks on the world which break CP, right? And then it translates into Dipole moment, but not. I mean, when you are taking an experiment over photon, but not Dipole, not short distance Dipole moment of quarks. Remember the calculation by say Hilbert.
Yeah, but this is really a four quark operator, right?
Yeah.
I'm not including anything at that level, right? So, let me go back.
No, yeah, right,
these
there.
Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's in there. I mean, this is just. This is what we were able to calculate. So the four quark contributions, there are some cases where you can estimate these, but, well, you know, right? I mean, it's not as straightforward to do it using some rules. So that they're in the rest here. So here, I'm just focusing on the quark EDMs just because that's the calculation that was done on the lattice. So dependence on pion mass, cutoff scale, and you know, if you compare, you know, these coefficients are roughly in the same proportion, right? The ratios actually agree to, say, 15%. But the size is different by a factor of two, almost exactly a factor of two. And so it's interesting to understand whether there's something one can get out of it. Now, you know, in terms of errors, it's not an issue, right? This was certainly within one theory sigma of this result, but there are a couple of things that are different here. So one is this is normalized at 2 GeV using sort of non-perturbative renormalization on the lattice. Now, what was the scale here? Now, I stuck in 0.9 GeV, but what you don't really know, right? The fitting procedure is a fitting of renormalized parameters. So you just have some physical quantities that you're trying to fit for. And the assumption is that they're normalized roughly at the scale of the nucleon mass. But in practice, if you look at the stability domain for the sum rule, it's slightly lower. So in reality, it looks like somewhere between 850 and 900 MeV, which is why I put this number a little lower. And so it's not completely trivial to run these things down from 2 GeV to somewhere below 1 GeV. I mean, you can use one loop renormalization, you get a shift of maybe 15%. But do you trust it, right? Certainly below a GeV, no real reason to trust that.
But they do run in such a way that if you could run,
they go up.
Yeah,
it does go up, yeah. So in that sense, it's what you would expect is that the coefficients at 2 GeV should be smaller in that sense. But it's, you know, as I said, if you use one loop running, it's like 15%. So it doesn't explain a factor of two. But maybe it does if you really understood how to run these things below a GeV. And in principle, I guess that could be done. But I suspect it's probably not just that. One of the things to keep in mind here is the result that I showed you is proportional to quark condensate divided by the nucleon coupling squared. The quark condensate that we used was normalized at 225 MeV. Current value would be somewhat higher, probably about 260. So that would go the other way. That would actually increase the coefficients rather than decreasing them. And so the question is, what about this coupling? So this is the value that we extracted from comparing different sum rules. Now, when Hisano and company did their calculation, instead of doing a fit, they decided to take the nucleon coupling from a direct measurement on the lattice by Aoki et al. And then run it down. That was at 2 GeV, ran it down to 1 GeV. And they got a number which is quite a bit larger, not quite a factor of 2. And it just turns out that if you plug in the new, or more modern value of the quark condensate and this larger coupling, you get exactly a reduction by a factor of 2. Now, is that accidental? Probably a little bit accidental. Well, so this, yeah, you've got to do, this is not quite 2, and this goes up as well, so you've got to calculate it.
So is that uncertainty is under
control
accurate?
I think it's just statistical. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, you tell me. But this was purely statistical. I'm not sure that this was, you know, this is not a complete calculation, or what you might think of as a complete calculation. So I mentioned that just sort of as an anecdote. I don't think it can be taken too seriously, but it may be suggesting that in fact this number is a little low. Now, what would go against that is that this comes from a fit, right? So if you change this number, then you mess up other quantities like the nucleon mass or the pi nucleon sigma term and so on. So it's not that easy actually to shift it. So I don't know the answer to this. I think you know, there may be something going on here that suggests that, you know, there's a little bit in between. These estimates of precision here are supposed to include not just statistics, but some idea of higher order effects as well. So hopefully we can learn a little bit more. But again, factor of 2 is not a huge thing. It's the coupling of the interpolating current to the ground state neutron. Now, the problem, as I said, there's this issue with how you choose the current. Now, on the lattice, it doesn't matter. You can choose, in principle, any one of these. But of course, when you do a calculation in the continuum, you make approximations, and so you have to try and estimate this. So as I said, there is an issue there, but it is a fit. So you don't have a lot of freedom to move it around, and it tends to come in squared. So the difference here is not that small. Practice. So anyway, I think there's still a question there as to what's going on. But currently, anyway, the lattice estimates are about a factor of 2 smaller than the ones we had. Although,
I don't think anybody on that lattice paper is here, so we'd have to look up how many lattice spacings. But in any case, for the calculation of the full bear
I think that's what they tried to do here. Yeah,
I think there's a full error budget for the tensor charges.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right,
so.
But for the lambda.
Oh, sorry, yes, right. Yes. This is an older calculation. I don't know if anyone has tried to redo this. I'm convinced this is just statistical, although we'd have to look at the paper to check. It has to be statistical. Okay, so one thing, this again is not perhaps an issue for the lattice, but one can get rid of this coupling just by taking ratios. Now, in practice, when you do the fit, that's what you do anyway, because you're comparing different quantities. So it's really the same thing as looking at, say, the ratio of EDM to the magnetic dipole moment, which is also calculated using some rules, or maybe the sigma term. These things have the same chiral structure, so the sum rules are somewhat similar. I'll just mention this briefly. It's more exploratory than this calculation. Again, several groups have been looking at calculating the neutron EDM as a function of theta, including people in this room. This is just one of the more recent estimates or calculations that's come out. This is from, does this group have a name? This is Horsley, Sheerholtz, and company.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just for comparison, so this is using this trick of making theta imaginary, and one can make that argument assuming theta is treated perturbatively, but they actually have to calculate it at quite large values of theta to see the signal, and then they get a number like this. So this is the statistical error. This is an estimate of higher order effects, which is about, say, a factor of 2 larger than the sum rules calculation. I think it's true to say that all of the lattice calculations for the theta dependence of the neutron EDM have been larger, And none of them are, I think, I'm sure all of the people working on it would agree, none of them are complete yet, including this one, in terms of various issues to do with finite size and scaling and so on. But this is, I think, the most precise number that I've seen quoted. Again, it's probably too early to interpret it too strongly.
9 is the last digit, right? So it's the
yeah, I mean, this is 25% or something. Yeah. So it looks quite precise. The question, I think, is, you know, that estimate is non-trivial, right? That's an estimate of some higher order effects. There's also the fact that they do this rotation, but then to simulate it, you have to simulate it at values of theta that are order 1 to see the signal, because it's, you know, you're looking for things that are suppressed by the light quark masses as well. So
non-linear effects.
Yes. So the question is, what about those non-linear effects? And so, in principle, this is where they're supposed to come in as an estimate that one can ask. But anyway, there's progress there, which I think is interesting. But this number has always been somewhat larger than the continuum calculation. And as I said, there are many subtleties that arise in the calculation of the theta dependence of the neutron EDM that do not arise actually for this calculation. It's really, I mean, it's interesting for that reason. It involves almost all of the symmetries you might worry about in QCD. And so it is a complicated thing to calculate. And so it's quite nice to see this coming out. And as I said, it's within a factor of 2 of the estimate that we had. And as I said, the strange quark contributions here are problematic in the continuum. So it'd be nice to get a handle on those. Okay, just a brief comment, because it's again an area where lattice calculations would be useful. I've just talked about the neutron EDM. There are all of these other parameters, and in particular the pion-nucleon couplings. There's a nice feature here that you can reduce the pion. So this is the coupling you're after, right? Pion coupling to the neutron state, which is produced by one of these CP violating sources. There are two ways you can do it. It's either the vertex here or it's the so-called rescattering diagram. And so what you really want is this matrix element if you reduce the pion. And so this is now a CP even matrix element. It's this chromomagnetic operator and just QQ bar. This combination, because of the definition of M naught squared, this combination actually vanishes if you replace the nucleon here with the vacuum. And that creates big problems when you try to calculate it using some rules, because these things tend to cancel. So the calculation goes along similar lines, but because of that cancellation, there are big errors in the coefficients. Again, it's consistent with naive dimensional analysis, but with much bigger errors. So that's an area where the lattice could be very useful. And as I said, this is not a CP violating matrix element, but again, it has these general issues of needing to look at disconnected diagrams and so on, because it's a singlet structure. So I won't say more about that, but that's probably the pressing question here, the dependence on these chromo EDM sources. And these are very important for interpreting the bound on the EDM of mercury, which is the strongest current constraint in that diamagnetic sector. There are other contributions that one can calculate. You can get the theta dependence of this guy relatively easily. That was done many years ago by Kruder et al. In the late 70s, a sort of first calculation of the theta dependence of that pion-nucleon coupling, and then actually the neutron EDM. The quark EDMs here are suppressed because they require some electromagnetic contribution. Okay, so that's just a discussion of some of these calculations that go into this part of the diagram. Here's a quick summary of some of the numbers. So for the neutron, this is just writing out the coefficients that I had before. This is this leading contribution to mercury EDM. And actually, coming back to the question at the beginning, this is the contribution that I haven't talked about from the electron EDM and some of these semi-leptonic operators to the, it's not really an EDM of the thorium monoxide molecule, it's more just a CP violating shift of the energy levels, but nonetheless you get the same kind of constraint. So this linear combination always enters, and so this relative coefficient turns out to be very similar for many different systems. So here, you know, precision 20-30% usually is what people would quote. We quoted 50% here, but maybe in some cases now perhaps the precision here is much better than 50% based on the lattice calculation. And here, well, okay, this is even worse. It's in not very good shape at all. And, you know, empirically, I think the importance of some of these calculational problems is that if there were a detection, say, of a neutron EDM or of the mercury EDM in the next few years, there's really no way we could distinguish that from any contribution other than theta, right? In principle, given the errors, both could contribute at that level. So we can't actually distinguish any of these other sources. Theta doesn't appear here because I've used this axion relaxation to remove it, but one could write it in terms of the full setter operators. Okay, that was the first part of the talk, but I have a feeling I've gone on a little long. What? Way too long? Okay, we're done. I can stop now if you want.
Well, you were going to draw some connections between these and some other quantities, right?
Yeah. What? So how quick do you want me to be?
We usually go to lunch at 12:30.
And what time is it now? 12:10. Okay, 5 minutes or so, then I'll. Okay. Sure. Okay, so. Yeah, I'm just going to make a few comments about interpreting these results. And, you know, EDMs are one example. I've sort of talked about the technical details, but at the end of the day, why are they interesting? It's because they can give us a hint, perhaps, or at least constrain possible models of new physics. And, you know, one way of thinking about this problem these days is that the empirical evidence is not always that helpful. So there is empirical evidence for new physics. All right, we have neutrino mass, or at least neutrino oscillations, dark matter. You know, this is places where we have data, and there's something to explain. The problem is that this by itself doesn't always point to particular places where you should be looking. It doesn't point to particular mass scales, really. And so there's a big question there. So, for example, neutrino mass is often interpreted using the seesaw mechanism, where you have the right-handed neutrinos at 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 GeV. That's certainly possible, but it's not the unique interpretation, right? You can also put the right-handed neutrinos at the same scale as the active neutrinos, have them as Dirac particles. And then the scale is way down here. So both will work. Both will give you neutrino oscillations. Similarly, dark matter, you know, again, there's the so-called WIMP miracle, where if you take a weak scale particle with a weak scale mass and weak scale interactions, you get the right annihilation rate. But it's, if you look a little more closely, it's a little bit trickier than that. I mean, it can't interact through Z exchange because that's too strong. If you really want it to interact with the weak bosons in the standard model, it generally has to be quite a bit heavier than the weak scale. It has to be, say, 10 TeV or something like that. And as soon as you introduce a new mediator, then you can have the whole mass range to play with. And of course, there are many other models of dark matter that are not WIMPs, axions, and so on. So again, a lot of parameter space in principle. And so the question, at least for the last part of the talk, is just if we have precision measurements, which are, they're not restricted really to mass scale or energy scale here, what's the easiest way to interpret the constraints or, in principle, a detection? And so traditionally the approach has been to write down the kind of effective field theory that I started with when I was talking about EDMs, assuming that everything is basically standard model up to the weak scale and then new physics above that at short distances. As I said, the empirical evidence doesn't really force that upon us. Maybe theoretical prejudice would, but one could try to be a little bit more general. And so I'm interested in thinking about the new physics scenarios that are actually involve light degrees of freedom and what precision measurements would have to say about that. Now, there are many different types of observables one could look at, but almost all of them involve QCD at some level when you go to low energies. So even the nice, the sort of clean ones, the nicest ones that don't have large standard model contributions, like EDMs or neutrinoless double beta decay or lepton flavor violation, because they violate some symmetry, as I've mentioned, they still require calculation if you want to interpret non-zero results. So one way to try and systematize this is to make an assumption that the new physics is hidden in the sense that it doesn't carry any standard model charges, gauge charges. So it's neutral under the standard model gauge group. And if you make that assumption, then you can write down an effective field theory expansion of the same kind of form that I had before, where you assume the new physics scale is lambda, which could be very heavy, doesn't have to be the weak scale, and then you just parameterize the interactions. And it turns out there are only three operators that you can write down that are unsuppressed by that scale, so renormalizable or relevant or marginal operators. And these are the three. There's kinetic mixing with hypercharge, because for U1, the field strength is gauge invariant, so you can mix the U1 with another U1. So this V here is another U1 gauge boson, dark photon or something like that. You can have mixing of singlets or singlet operators with the Higgs through H-H. And you can have, of course, singlet fermions that mix through LH. And of course, this is just the right-handed neutrino coupling, but it could be any singlet fermion. Other than those interactions, if you assume at least the standard model chiral structure, then everything else is suppressed by this scale. Now, of course, if this is the weak scale, then it may not be that suppressed, and you might not worry about it. But if you really think that scale could be very heavy, which is consistent with current data, then these are the kinds of interactions you'd want to probe. Of course, they don't exist unless you have these new degrees of freedom. But one question you can ask then is, what are the constraints on the existence of these types of interactions? And there are only three of them, so it's not, although it's more model dependent perhaps than just looking at these higher dimensional operators involving standard model fields, it's not too model dependent. And so one can ask about the precision measurements and what they say about these types of operators. So the nice thing is that if you go to low energies and you integrate out the heavy degrees of freedom here, for example, in this case the Higgs, you've got the Z as well, then they're just simple couplings between this extra boson, in this case the electromagnetic current, the extra singlet, and the scalar current. And here, well, really at low energies, this is just providing neutrino mixing. And then you can follow through the results of that. So if you're looking at the physics, then you just look at anywhere you would have the electromagnetic current or the scalar current. And again, often this enters in the hadronic sector as well. And so, okay, there's a long list of things one could look at and say that, you know, there are two sort of vertices one can think about here. What I was showing you before, these are all the sort of mediator fields, but they can couple to other things in this hidden sector. You can build more complicated models, but there are only those three mediators. So there are precision corrections, some ones of interest perhaps for me, things like lepton G-2, EDMs. There are rare decays to final states that are part of the standard model. There are rare decays to final states that are not part of the standard model, and therefore in this framework would always be hidden. And one can also think about anomalous scattering signatures, which are kind of interesting because it's the same signature you would look at for neutrino experiments or for dark matter detection and various other things in astrophysics and cosmology. Yeah, so G-2 would look like this. So if I allow this extra U1 gauge boson, then because the electromagnetic current is there, I can draw a diagram like this, right? This is just mixing between the photon and this vector. So at low energies, just replace the hypercharge here with the photon. So there's kinetic mixing proportional to this coefficient kappa. And this is just the Schwinger diagram here, so the not a hard calculation to do. In the limit where this vector is light compared to, say, the muon, then you just get the Schwinger term, rescaled by kappa. In the limit where it's heavy, you get mass dependence here, and this is the kind of scaling that people were interested in supersymmetric models. So if you're going to use this to explain the muon G minus 2 discrepancy in a system where this vector is heavy, you're using this scaling. But you can also use it in a system where the vector is actually light. Oh, yeah, sorry.
This has sort of been ruled out now by data, right? I mean, at least the simple
data. Yeah. Yes and no. So, yes, in the simplest, so this is exactly. I mean, there's a lot of interest in this, and so people focused on it. And the nice thing is that because it's at low energy, you can do something, often without spending a order $10 billion. And so this is the most recent plot of the constraints on that vector parameter space. So this is the kinetic mixing term, this is the mass of the vector. And all of these, almost all of these are new experiments, which is the nice thing about it. Now this band is the region you want to live in if you, you know, you think the muon G minus 2 discrepancy is there and is going to stay. And this is the solution to it, right? So you want to live in this band. And as of earlier this year, the last little remaining part of that band was excluded. Now, of course, this band is arbitrarily chosen. Maxime chose it about 7 or 8 years ago as sort of a 3 sigma definition. So you can move it around a bit if you want. But it's useful as motivation, and so that that was indeed excluded as the minimum model. However, right. So this is, there are several different constraints here. So this one is G minus 2 of the electron. So you cannot shift G minus 2 of the electron too much because that's a very precisely measured quantity. And now there are enough measurements that, you know, it constrains alpha, so there's not much you can do. So you have to live below that blue line. Yeah, so for some reason this one wasn't filled in, but that region is excluded. Yeah. At 3 sigma anyway. And then this is an experiment that was looking, well, it's actually old data from kaon decays, but they were looking at rare decays of pions to this vector, which is then decays to leptons. And so they were able to exclude this region. Similar reanalysis of data from Babar excludes the higher mass region as well. And then APEX is a new experiment at JLab. Well, it's the analysis. I don't think there's anything more than that. I mean, you're doing some kind of a multi-parameter analysis, right, to get the strongest constraint. It always looks a little odd to me as well, but. Yeah, it's an assumption. So. Yeah, in principle, you can imagine, and because of the motivation here, as I said, one of the motivations is thinking about dark matter. You can throw in extra states that it could, you know, this vector could decay to. Now they have to be light, of course, because this only, at least this region only goes up to around 100 MeV. But if you do that, So I haven't got a plot to show you, but many of these constraints then disappear. So the shift of G minus 2 of the electron doesn't. That's universal. This constraint goes away because this was basically looking at a fixed target sort of beam dump, and if you add in states that this vector can decay into that are invisible, often you shorten the decay length, and anyway you wouldn't see them. So this goes away. All of these go away because they look at final state leptons. There are some other constraints that come in. There's a constraint from decays of rare decays of kaons, k plus to pi plus nu nu bar, where you can have k plus to pi plus and the vector, and then the vector decays invisibly. So that gives you a constraint roughly like this. But there's a little bit of this G minus 2 band that's still around in that case. So to answer Tom's question, it's killed if there's nothing else but this vector. But if you add in extra degrees of freedom, it's not killed. What a surprising answer. Yeah, so not too surprising, right? That you can get around it, but in fact, it's not. There's not that much left even there, right? There's a little bit of space here, There's another Babal limit that looked for invisible decays that kills most of the parameter space in that case as well. So most of it has gone in practice. So it's not quite as bad as it might sound. You cannot, you know, modify these models endlessly, because it's all at low energy and there is a lot of overlapping constraints. Okay, I need to finish. So I just want to mention one more thing. One can look at, you know, this sort of set of precision constraints a little more holistically, or at least this is what we tried to do, is just a simple analysis, and say, let me throw in anything I like into this hidden sector, but I'm only allowed to use these three portal couplings, for example. Or maybe I'll generalize it slightly and allow non-anomalous gaugings like B minus L and L mu minus L tau, just because they're completely UV insensitive. So you're just saying this is infrared new physics, nothing else at high scales. Anything else that I put in, even if it's light, will be inconsistent. For example, it might be anomalous, or it's still, even if it's non-anomalous, it might require charge degrees of freedom that are necessarily heavy. And it turns out that most of the leptonic observables, we just talked about G minus 2, can be explained at current sensitivity with a model like this, but many of the hadronic observables cannot. And so it sort of says that if you see a discrepancy in, say, you know, one of the rare hadronic decays, something like beta S gamma or something like that, that in practice it's not really possible to explain it with a hidden sector model, a light hidden sector model of this type. EDMs are sort of interesting, and this is the last thing I'll mention. They don't fall into this pattern, so even for the lepton EDM, we were not able to construct, well, we didn't try that hard, but we were not able to construct a sort of generic model that would produce an EDM at the current level using this light hidden sector. So here are two diagrams. Generically, everything's at two loops. Here are two diagrams that would contribute. So this is the electron line, the photon, and then two W loops. And what you're using here is the neutrino portal. So it brings in one of these singlet neutrinos. But if you then account for the constraints on the light neutrino mass spectrum, you can't really make this larger than about 10 to the minus 33. So it's a valid diagram, and it could be large enough, but it's constrained by light neutrinos, knowledge of the light neutrino mass spectrum, and so it doesn't work. So you can also use a diagram like this, kind of Bar-Z diagram, where you make things more complicated, you turn on this mixing between the photon and a vector, and you introduce some CP violation and a hidden sector with some extra fermions. So it's, you know, it's kind of messy, not terribly interesting by itself. But even that, even though it's only a two-loop diagram, this cannot be large enough either. Remember, the current limit here is 10 to the minus 29, so it gets closer, but not really that close. And the reason is this plot that I just showed you. It's the same coupling that's entering here, right? There's a kinetic mixing kappa here. There's a mixing on the Higgs line as well that we've introduced. That's constrained by rare meson decays. And so these limits are too strong. So that's what constrains this number. So in that sense, it's kind of nice that you can see that this isn't totally open-ended. And so, sorry? Here? It's sitting in here. It's just, yeah, it's just this CP, well, pseudoscalar coupling of fermion to the scalar. So, I mean, nothing nice about this model. It's just do whatever you can, you still can't make it large enough. Now, of course, if you tried harder, maybe you could get something, but we didn't want to make it completely baroque. But it's baroque, but not completely baroque. I don't know. Yes, it's all. Maybe we already tried too hard. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's a reasonable statement here, that if you measure a non-zero electron EDM, most likely it's pointing to UV new physics, not some light hidden sector, which I think is interesting. Can't quite say the same thing for the hadronic EDMs, because you can always explain them with theta, as I mentioned before, which is not bringing in new heavy physics directly anyway. Okay, so just a quick summary. Just mentioned in the first part of the talk, and that's what I'll focus on here, this question of calculating the dependence of observable EDMs on different CP violating sources, and I emphasize some of these matrix elements. So the quark EDMs require these particular matrix elements of the nucleon, the tensor charges, and there is progress there. Maybe some interesting questions to see whether the normalizations are, well, there's something, there's any physical information in the, what looks like a reduction in the overall normalization by a factor of two. And then I mentioned particularly this matrix element, CP-even matrix element, which would be relevant for computing CP-odd pion-nucleon couplings. And then finish just with some, as I said, more philosophical discussion about interpreting these measurements in terms of different new physics scenarios that are all contained in the infrared rather than the ultraviolet. Okay, sorry for running on too long. Unfortunately not, so let's see if I can get back here. Oops. So the operators that we need to improve the standard model prediction would be, no. Sorry, right back. Not even there. Here. Basically these ones. So, for example, certain combinations here of these four quark operators are the ones that dominate the neutron and the mercury EDM. I think I have it here, yes. So these are actually four quark contributions. This again is, well, there's a combination of things that come in here. It's a combination, I guess, of QED and nuclear physics as well. But yeah, these are the ones that are perhaps the most problematic. So that would require some four quark matrix elements, CP violating four quark matrix elements.